I should say at the beginning that if I appear to be either nervous or rushed, it's not because I don't love each and every one of you, but it's because we have a vote at 5:30 in Washington, D.C., which is where the Congress is located. If I leave at 1, it now being 1:03, I will make the vote, maybe. So that's not your fault, that's my fault. And so if you'll forgive me, I'm just going to stay seated, make my remarks. And I've had this wonderful conversation with, he insists on Mo, but I call him Mr. Gadot, and about his wonderful out-of-the-box, will absolutely work, but not yet totally tested to his satisfaction, solution to a lot of problems you're discussing today. Let me also say that James, you all know James Reed, and James Reed, along with a lot of other people, James, if you'd stand just for a second, is always the person who gets everybody to come to what they need to come to, gets speakers, does the organizing. Very recently, my chief of staff, Kerry Yates, who many of you know, was offered the position of chief of staff, principal advisor to the president of Johns Hopkins University, not only the university, but all of the healthcare systems. I think that's a better salary than what she's making, but more importantly, it's a whole new life for her. And I'm not going to miss a beat because James Reed is going to be my chief of staff. So get used to that. When he calls, please answer. Thank you all for being here. And I think our last broadband summit, we've had three or four. I think the last one was in 2009. And it's amazing how much in the 4 years since then that we've accomplished. It's also more amazing how much we have yet to do, because in this business, you're not done until you're really done. I predicted that we were onto something very big. Just to show you that I was a genius, I was right. And at that time, less than 72% of West Virginians had access to broadband. It was larger on a national basis, but West Virginia is hard, not only because of our topography, which is not friendly to wireless. So there are a lot of towers in our future, and we're going to love all of those towers. They'll be colored whatever your favorite color is. We'll do that for you. But anyway, today it's 91% coverage, still not good enough. I have my roots, as you know, as a Vista volunteer in a town that as yet does not yet have coverage. It does have potable water, but it does not have internet service, I do not believe. So one never stops on these things. Any great crusade takes a lot of time. We've made a lot of strides, and we're going to make more. Our keynote speaker today was Jessica Rosenworcer, commissioner, and she knows just how critical all of these things are. And all I have to say about Jessica, if I could only put in words what a privilege it was to be able to work with her when she was on the Commerce Committee and since, and how much she taught me. Sometimes it was just no words were exchanged. Just knowledge flowed from her to me. It's going to be like your new project. But Jessica, thank you for everything and always. I want to thank all of our attendees. We're here about broadband access because we want to amplify innovation. We want to amplify growth, business opportunities. Early on, we could see the potential of high-speed internet to improve our schools and our small businesses. I'm very happy about the library award because when Olympia Snow and I, unfortunately she couldn't take the raucous partisanship in the Senate and she didn't run the last time, but we started this thing called the E-Rate. And yes, it was going to go into schools, but it was also going to go into libraries because adults don't go to school and they go to libraries. And now everybody goes to libraries and school. So if it's 6 million people that went to the libraries last year, that's extraordinary. And they all had access to whatever we have to offer them. And I'm very happy about that. When all said and done, these joint efforts will bring in more than $500 million in public and private broadband investments in West Virginia, and we will make good use of it. I'm very proud to have played a role in that. And you're right, I've very aggressively pursued, I'm not even going to look at Maggie, but everybody who's run a telecommunications company in West Virginia has had a withering first conversation with me. And we all end up really good friends because they make a lot of progress, just like Maggie did. But this deal has to be 100% before we're all happy. Those companies did respond with millions of dollars of investments to build wireline and wireless broadband networks throughout the state, and they did that. And do you lose money when you do that to the far reaches of southern West Virginia? Yes, you do. And I'm not in business, so I don't mourn that. They are in business, and they make pretty good profits, sometimes not as big as they want, especially if it's a smaller company, but it's part of what one has to do. Now it's sort of the bottom line. Everybody is equal. Everybody has to be treated fairly. The BTOP grant has been a great thing for West Virginia. The rollout and the implementation of that BTOP grant in West Virginia has not been quite as seamless as we'd hope, but who cares? We got the money. We're using the money, and no one can argue that West Virginians don't stand to benefit enormously from expanded broadband availability when the project is completed. Unfortunately, many in Washington believe, and this boggles my mind, it saddens me, and I can't find an answer to it, but we'll just have to wait till things sort themselves out. They really believe that this is the time to stop doing infrastructure development, whether it's highways or whether it's broadband or whatever. No new money, please. No, don't spend any new money on everything. No matter that the budget deficit has been cut in half, no matter, we just don't want to spend any money. Well, you can't do broadband, you can't do all the things that Mr. Gadot wants to do and will do, and that we all need done in telecommunications, thus giving our rural and remote and often impoverished families a chance to see that there's another world out there that they can connect with, and it can change their lives, and will change their lives. The reality of broadband deployment, particularly in the remote areas, is it takes public money, it takes public support. Yes, we have private partnerships, we have public partnerships, but you have to have public money. We now have a lot of natural gas being done in West Virginia. And CONSOL said they're going to stop mining coal, they're going to do natural gas. And natural gas brings with it enormous challenges that Carl Irwin's going to, wherever you are, Carl, that you're going to solve for us. Because they have these 120,000-ton trucks that carry the water, which is needed to help develop the, after the platform has been developed, help to shoot that down to force the rock under the geology underneath to frack, to break up, and to produce natural gas. So it's going to be a whole new level of environmental challenges and other kinds of challenges as everybody goes crazy all across the country, and particularly where they have incredible quantities of natural gas like we do. And natural gas is cleaner than coal. It's also half as dirty as coal. So it's twice as clean as coal and half as dirty as coal. And the public accepts it without thinking. But we have a lot of work to do in public policy. And the environmental and the business community has a lot of work to do to know that when they're going into geology, that geology will hold, and that trucks will be able to get over bridges only built for 85,000 tons, which is what our bridges are in West Virginia. That is not the interstate bridges, but all the other bridges. And that means that people's front yards get ruined because people with those huge trucks can't make sharp right turns, so they just go right through somebody's front yard. And I'm sorry they do that. They do that, and we have to face up to that. So we need to be investing more in infrastructure. We need to be a lot more in infrastructure, infrastructure writ large, education, everything, and obviously communications. I want to do everything possible so that all West Virginians are on the right side of the digital divide. That's sort of my, I guess I could have said that and walked out. That's my philosophy. That's what I believe. You got to be on the right side of the digital divide. And thanks to the close collaboration we share between the state, the federal government, and invested stakeholders, we are closer than ever. Right here in Morgantown, the super Wi-Fi network that WVU is building holds substantial promise. People should be proud of that. Carl, you should be proud of that, wherever you are, Carl. Since it goes places that regular Wi-Fi cannot go. It's exactly the type of innovative thinking that rural communities will need to overcome these difficulties that they have. Innovative thinking, and you're going to hear about that from the speaker on my right and on your left. And then when we have Google Noon, a project that defines thinking out of the box, which I love, because when it comes from a company like that, and when it's run by a man like you, you know it's going to work. And is it going to be like anything we've ever done before? No. Does that matter? No. If it solves our problems, does that matter? Yes. That's all that matters. So it's going to be successful. It's going to connect every West Virginian to high, and everybody else to high-speed internet. It requires floating balloons into the stratosphere. I offered to attach myself to one of my balloons, those balloons, so I could really get a good view. Because I've never been in space that high before, but they said that the oxygen ran out, so I decided not to do that. But it's going to have a huge effect on broadband technology, and I'm very proud about it. A perfect example of this is in our schools. By all measures, the bipartisan E-Rate program that I created with Senator Olympia Snow, marvelous person from Maine. The number of classrooms connected to the internet has gone 14% in West Virginia to 93% today. And I love the 93%, but my job is to worry about the 7%. That's my job, right, Jessica? I have to worry about the 90%, I'm commissioner. I have to worry about the 7%. So we can't rest. We don't have laurels to rest on until it's 100%. The demand for better broadband connectivity and technology in our schools and our libraries continues to increase. I was staggered when we were told that 6 million people went to West Virginia libraries. That's just amazing to me, and only shows the importance of all of this that we're talking about. So the demand for the better connectivity is going to keep going, and that's good. I was thrilled, and I was actually worried about this statement because I wasn't sure if it would be taken positively or negatively. I mean it positively, but I want you to take it positively. I was thrilled earlier this year when President Obama became the latest partner in that effort. That's a positive statement, okay? Nobody can attach anything negative to that. But I worried about that sentence. You know, you got to get on early in these things. You got to start fighting right at the beginning, and you don't quit until it's all over. And obviously, I know that Commissioner Rosenworcel shares this as a priority for the Federal Communications Commission. We have given more and more West Virginians access to a stronger future since our first broadband summit in 2006. Therefore, this is our third summit. It contributes to so much for so many. It strengthens our first responders and crises and agencies. It brings to mind the whole FirstNet effort, which is probably a $15, $20 billion effort, which will take 10 years to do. But we'll have every first responder, every firefighter, every local policeman with the same handheld device all over the country, EMT, everything. So there will be seamless responding to crises, of which there are many in West Virginia. And it will overcome that irresistible urge we have in America for turf. We have it in Congress. We have it everywhere. But our new FirstNet will not have that at all. So that's sort of it for me. But I'm not important in this. I, I'm I'm important because I'm introducing Mr. Gadot, who's the vice president of Google. He and I have had a brief conversation, and I've already put him in my list of best friends. He's here to tell us about a very exciting process that holds enormous promise for delivering internet access to rural communities like those here in West Virginia. Mr. Gadot, welcome to Morgantown. Forgive me for leaving.
Senator, thank you very much for the invitation. To start with, this is the first time we speak about Loon publicly. As a matter of fact, I think the invitation from yourself and the fact that it's West Virginia is definitely the best place to start. Having been announced as one of your best friends, I think we're done, so I can basically leave. No, actually, so you may notice the tie. I am from Google, so the tie is very unusual, but I actually decided to wear the tie because what I'm going to tell you about is going to appear quite crazy, okay? So you know, it adds a tiny bit of seriousness to what we're going to talk about. I'll just wait for a second, for a minute, until the senator. Okay, yeah, sure. So to start with, we have this little unit in Google that is called Google X. How many of you are aware of Google X? Okay, so maybe I should, I actually decided to put a few slides at the beginning to tell you what we do. So Google is not the the most normal company you will ever think of, and X is like the odd, the crazy part of Google, if you want. So it does get quite interesting. What we do at X is basically innovate beyond the normal day-to-day level of innovation. We innovate at scale. So I'll tell you very quickly what it is that we try to do. But and maybe I should ask you first to take a quick look around you. I'm not sure this is working. Oh, there you go. So take a quick look around you. Other than a few of the gentlemen in this room, I want you to try and spot anything that was that you used today that was available less than 50 years ago. Your mobile phones, this mic, the internet, the cars that you drove, the navigation systems on them, and so on and so forth. Just leave you a couple of seconds to think about that. The reality of the matter is that so many of the things that we take for granted are actually things that were invented in the last 15 years. All of the texting, all of the you know, mobile communications, all of the browsing on your little phones, almost everything that we deal with on daily basis is a major innovation. I don't know why this thing is not moving. Oh, there you go. So those major innovations actually are all changing the world in such a drastic way. But not only have they been mostly invented in the last 15 years, the most interesting part of them is that had I told you about them 25 years ago, you would have said that I'm absolutely crazy to speak about those things. So you know, is it possible actually that more things in the future of that nature will be part of our lives? And being an Egyptian, I actually realized that I'll move to the other side to be. So being an Egyptian, I realized that if I had told the pharaohs back when they were building the pyramids out of 70-ton stones, they would have probably, about cement, they would have probably said cement, rocks in a bag, and you add water to it and it becomes a 70-ton rock, you're absolutely crazy. Let's keep on carrying 70-ton rocks. And if you asked anyone with a cart how to put 720 horsepowers into his cart, he would have just thought of a technology to add 720 horses to the ones that they already have. And the reality is that we constantly underestimate the possibility. Cement is just part of everyday life, and Ferrari has just sold, announced a 700 horsepower car. And it's just done by changing things so drastically, not doing more of what you're doing. And I think this has crossed from cement and mobile phones into absolute science fiction. So these are three of the famous science fiction movies of the last 20 years. I particularly would like to point out Minority Report, if you have seen that.
Minority Report is the 2006 movie. It's not that old. And when we all saw it, we thought of that amazing computer interface he used as an outstanding technology, truly science fiction, truly visionary. Less than 3 years later, it was available in every Xbox, right? So the reality is that some of the things that we took as science fiction a few years ago became absolute science fact in no time. And the cycle is moving so quickly, okay? So I will now actually challenge you to think about two other science fiction things that may have not happened and just see how far you're willing to accept this. Telepathy is when you speak to people without speaking. And teleportation is when I can stand on a stand and end up in Washington instead of going that quickly, of going through with a car. So do you think those will happen, be honest, in the next 5 to 10 years? Not a single hand in the room. Okay, so what if I tell you that in a way or a shape or a form, both of these are already existing? Okay, they already happen today, as a matter of fact, repeatedly. So telepathy I do with my kids all the time on those little phones. You know, we're always exchanging ideas on text, on WhatsApp, on Hangouts, and so on and so forth. And we don't really speak. It's exactly like telepathy. I think the only difference we need to do is to get rid of the screen and the keyboard. And that's, by the way, happening very, very quickly. Huh? So very quickly, there will be ways where you can simply communicate with computers without a screen and a keyboard, right? Teleportation is an interesting one, because today, a form of moving objects from one place to the other is called 3D printing. If you have not seen 3D printing, please watch some videos on YouTube. But I can definitely take an object like that, scan it or design it, and print it on the space shuttle. Okay? As it is, it will go out the other side. Most of mechanical objects will actually work. You can have gears in them. They can work as a tool or a gear. So this is already happening. Now, the reason I put this out there is because most people like yourselves, and respectfully so, will not raise their hand if I say about something that is absolute science fiction, if it's going to happen in the next 5 years, they normally say, no, not possible. Now, that's what we do at Google X. We try and get a bunch of people in there that are crazy enough to actually believe that everything is possible, okay? So we actually work on some projects that are of that nature. Now, let me tell you what qualifies a project to be a part of Google X. We try to look for projects that, for starters, solve a huge problem for humanity. So a problem that affects a few million people is not the scale we want to work on. We actually look for problems that will change the lives of 100 million, 200 million people around the world, or more, okay? We try to find the radical solution for it, so not something that is just more horses in front of the cart. We actually try to change the cart completely. So not X percent improvements, but 10X improvement, as we call them. And then we try to find the breakthrough technology to use that. So if it's possible to use technology to solve that radical solution, it will qualify within X. And in very simple terms, we try to move beyond bits and bytes like we do in Google. So not only software, in X we also allow ourselves to work with atoms and particles. So we work with real things. So we call those moonshots. The three that we have announced so far publicly are Chauffeur, the driverless cars, Glass, and Loon. Okay? So I'm going to cover for the rest of my presentation Project Loon. Back in May, we went out to New Zealand, and without, surprisingly, we could manage to keep it confidential until then. But then we launched around 12 balloons that gave internet access to people in New Zealand, around 50 friendly testers, as we call them, friends and family of Googlers. And we basically flew those to prove the concept, but most importantly, to open up to talk to the rest of the industry and the technology and the governments around the possibility of Loon. As I was telling the senator in our short conversation, when we get to that point, the breakthrough technology has already been found, discovered. It's just engineering and hard work that we need to do to get those things done. So for example, Google Glass, when we launched that, the very first prototype of Glass was 6 kilograms. And you know, we knew that by finding a way to do the wearable computing, we can, engineering-wise, work hard to make it work. So let's define in X format, why does Loon qualify? So one is a huge problem. Is there really a problem with broadband, with the internet? I think you would agree, being in this room, that what matters really is the 7%, not the 97% or the 93% that are connected, right? So to get to the 7%, the industry faces either very difficult terrain or very difficult financial decisions that are in many ways not justifying building more towers in the rest of the areas that are uncovered. More so in emerging markets. So it's not 793 like it is in West Virginia. It's actually 4.8 billion people that are not connected to the internet and will not be connected mostly if we follow the same model. Okay, that is one for every two. That is two for every one human that has connection. So 2/3 of the world population does not have connection. More importantly, our industry is used to measuring coverage by what we call population coverage. So if we say there is 91% of a certain country or city that have access, that's 91% coverage of the population, okay? It's not coverage of the geography. As a matter of fact, in many of the advanced markets around the world, less than half of the geography is covered, which means that if you walk 2.5 miles out of the main roads or main cities, you may not get coverage. I just posted here a map of West Virginia, right? And in reality, the geography coverage can be a challenge. The third one, as the senator rightly pointed out, is the crisis response, right? So crisis response is, this is an article after Hurricane Sandy. And as much as we would love to have a world without those disasters, they do happen. And when they do happen, here it took a full week until we could restore connectivity. I met with the telecoms in Japan, and it took them 4.5 months to restore full connectivity after the tsunami. So it is definitely at the time where we need connectivity most that we don't get it. So Loon tries to solve that with a very radical solution, if you want. We decided, instead of building more towers or improving the technology to build towers or finding a better way to lay fiber, we thought it would be cool if we flew the towers, right? So we actually thought if you put towers up at 19 kilometers in the sky and put enough of them, they would actually give unobstructed coverage to provide broadband everywhere, okay? Which is really a simple idea, but the problem with those things is that up there, the world is very harsh. It's minus 65 degrees Celsius. I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit, but it's really bad, okay? It is on one side of the balloon, the sun is burning it. On the other side, it's below freezing. And the electronics don't behave the same way. And those balloons in general do not really obey what we want them to do. They normally go up and then pop and then fall, right? So we found a technology, the breakthrough technology, that basically allows us to navigate those balloons. Not only do we want to keep them up in the sky for 100 days at a time for every balloon, but we can also tell them where to go. We cannot tell them very precisely to where to go, but by choosing a friendly wind, by varying the altitude of the balloon, we can tell the balloon to go on a wind that is going west a little faster than the other wind that it was floating at. And by doing that through a system we call mission control, we can keep the distance between those towers fixed at 32 kilometers, right? Now, once you do that, you will always have a balloon on top of you in the sky. So let me take you through a quick photo gallery and tell you about what happens there. We use polyethylene that is a 0.3 of a millimeter. A thick plastic bag filled with helium or hydrogen. And that bag is so thin and fragile, but through design and a very interesting design, we aim to keep that plastic bag afloat for 100 days. We're actually doing very well on our targets when it comes to that front. We then power it, which is an amazing, amazing difference between today's telecom technology, where if you go to remote places, you have to power those things with, power generators, provide fuel to them, maintain them, and so on and so forth. Up there, there is an abundance of sunlight in the mornings, right? So we power them by solar cells that are enough to power them through the day, but also charge the batteries for the nighttime, anywhere between 66 degrees in the north and 66 degrees in the south is actually something that we can power the balloons constantly, and they will continue to be operational. Let me show you then what happens when the balloons are up there. A quick video of simulation of what happens when they're flying up there. So as you can see, if you let the balloons flow, they will just go anywhere. They will flow freely and they will have no control whatsoever. We don't know where they are. The gaps are different. Once we introduce the mission control thrust of finding the right wind, as you can see, they start to become uniform. And even though they're not all in the same, flying in the same direction, because the winds up there are very different, we actually can manage to get them to all flow as a flock of balloons, right? I don't know if that's the right English word, but anyway, they flow together and they basically behave as if they are one group, one meshed networks. They communicate to each other five balloons apart, okay? And then because they are so uniformly distributed, they can actually cover every spot of the earth at a fraction of rolling out fiber and building towers, okay? More importantly, I'll come to that in a second. More importantly, we use most of the work that started at the beginning is we use something we call mission. We built something called mission control. This is a very sophisticated piece of software, Google Scale, if you want, that actually uses all of the knowledge we had on Google Earth and all of the weather forecast and so on to predict the wind directions, but also to be able to do things like geofence the balloons so we can actually switch radios on and off at any point in time, and basically manage the navigation so that we can keep all of the balloons on a constant path. Some of our engineers sitting in the back there, being Googlers as they normally are, were not very happy with that. So they decided to push it a little further. I don't know why we do this, but anyway, they decided to push it a little further and decided to experiment with choosing directional winds that can actually not only allow us to be hovering, to be constantly on top of same distances between the mesh, but actually get the balloons to behave in more interesting ways. So I'll show you in a quick video. What we're trying to do here is we gave them the task of using mission control to shoot for those red dots in Australia and Chile and Argentina. Okay, so rather than just have the balloons fly everywhere, we want to be able to give more coverage to those cities or villages. So what you can see here, we're launching the balloons from around Australia. We can choose winds that can actually hover back and give coverage to that red dot, then go faster over the oceans. So we zoom through the oceans because we may not need coverage in that area, and then zoom again on top of, hover again on top of the cities, which basically allows us to have the redundancy we need if one balloon fails for any reason to actually get other balloons to behave in a way that provides coverage that is telco grade, as we call it. Okay? So I spent a lot of time to talk about the balloon side of it, because really this is the rocket science element. Even though solving the telecom bit and behaving electronic, having the electronics behave in such an environment is quite a challenge, but truly the rocket science is the balloon science. Now, how did it work so far? This is the result from the New Zealand pilot.
When I'm using the internet, the first thing I'll check is the weather and see if my sheep are going to dry out. At the moment, the wool's not dry. So I'm just looking for a window so I can plan my week.
All right, coming out in 3, 2, 1.
Works amazing. In the pilot, we used ISM, we used Wi-Fi, basically, just because we didn't have regulatory cooperation with the telcos and the regulators at the time to have a licensed spectrum. It worked at almost DSL speeds. Of course, we moved away from that. We are actually proud to say that we're going to fly LTE in cooperation with one of the telcos in the US this week as a test flight in far away from coverage area. We think we can get LTE actually within a few quarters to be the standard on Loon. The way LTE will work is it will give us somewhere around 10x, again, surprisingly, 10x the coverage we could get with Wi-Fi and 10x the speed we could get with Wi-Fi. Not only that, since New Zealand, we redesigned our power systems completely, so we have now something around double the power capacity that we could have in the past. And we have also improved our flight time around 20-fold. So our first few flights in New Zealand actually flew all the way around from New Zealand to Argentina, Chile, but we basically behaved and landed them before they cross over that air traffic space because we didn't have approvals on that. Hopefully the next flights we will have will be long duration flights which hopefully will orbit the Earth a couple of times. So what does that mean to the industry? And I think one of the things I'm truly proud, I've worked with the telecoms industry all my life, and I understand the challenge, and I also understand the opportunity we have here. So we started by one very important aspect that we actually wrote on all of our publications. We are too small to connect 5 billion people. We cannot do that as a company, right? So the problem is so big that we need the whole world to help us on this. So we actually publicly are working, so publicly we announce and we work very closely with all telcos that we can find around the world, basically to become, so our vision is to become a balloon fleet operator that leases assets to those players so that they can use those assets to provide access wherever they do not have access. And the way we think about it is that, if we can get the telecom providers to be interested in this, and we have so far not gotten a single no for any telco that we spoke to, and we get the regulators and governments to see the value of how we do this, we think that the benefits are really amazing. So for us to roll out on top of West Virginia, as the senator was saying, the terrain sometimes can work against us. But if you imagine that we can have those balloons flying on top of West Virginia, we don't need to build towers, we don't have to pay construction costs, we don't need to have backhaul, whether it's fiber or a satellite. You don't need to operate them, you don't need to maintain them. Power is free. When we need to maintain it, we land it to maintain it, and hopefully we will not need that often. We don't have to put fuel behind it, we don't have to put electricity for it, and so on and so forth. And the rollout time is instantaneous. So I visited and had the pleasure of working with the government of India, and they, for them, they have 1 billion unconnected people, 1 billion people that do not have access to the internet. To get to those people, they need to roll out something like 200,000 miles of fiber, and it would take them 5.5 years. I could probably cover India with 10,000 balloons across the whole radius, and within weeks, every one of those billion people would have access. So far it's been an amazing transformation. Most of the telcos, all of the telcos we spoke to were very interested and asked us to come back when we're ready, and hopefully we will be ready soon. So with that, I will stop and maybe open up for questions if we have time, or thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you very much. Very, very stimulating, a little unnerving. Yeah, lots going on, thinking about things. Thank you very much, Mo, for sharing that and sharing part of what goes on at Google X. Must be a neat place. We do have time for questions and comments. We do have the microphones set up here, so great opportunity to talk to someone who's at the forefront of thinking and living the future. Questions or comments from anyone? Yes, please come up and identify yourself and fire away.
Thanks for being here. My name is Shannon with Senator Manchin's office, and you had touched on air traffic and sovereignty rights and all that kind of stuff, and there are certainly some countries that I would not expect would allow you to fly the balloons over their territory. How would you compensate for that? Is the technology there? Is it matured at that point so you could avoid certain places?
So we can, but we don't. We would prefer not to. So we think that everyone should have access. So you're absolutely touching on the most interesting points. Surprisingly, while the technology is absolute science fiction, in Loon we actually have two plans going in parallel. One is we call it the technology track, and the other we call the diplomacy track. We tend to believe that from one side, the benefit will at a point in time outweigh the concerns, but we also are offering very open cooperation possibilities with the governments that would help us to fly over and so on. Balloons at 19 kilometers are governed by basically the weather balloon regulations, which surprisingly would allow us to fly everywhere, almost everywhere. But we understand that some governments will say, hey, but I want to know more about that, so we're working on that from one side. From the other side, we think, you know, we call it the street view dilemma. So a technology that has a tremendous value for the world, but is new, will always get a lot of resistance. And hopefully there will always be a few early adapters that will say, okay, we like this, we want to see it in our countries. Right? Once we get those few early adapters to show for the value that they got out of that, we get what we now get in Google, where countries are sometimes, especially in the emerging sides of the world, will come to us and say, when are you going to get Street View to my country? Because seriously, that's really important, okay? So we think that this is so ground-changing that with the, allying ourselves with the ones that are visionary and moving forward, hopefully very quickly we'll get the others to realize that. The last point is that, as I said, we are extremely open about our partnership approach to this. As a matter of fact, I have had, I've visited every continent on Earth in the last 3.5 months. I've met what would be maybe in the hundreds of very influential CEOs and policymakers. And our approach is actually quite interesting. We ask for what they would like to see so that we make it work. So we don't just go and tell them this is how it's going to be. For most telco, as a matter of fact, the business model on Loon was dictated to us by telecom operators. Of course, keeping the consumer in mind, but we asked them, we said, what would you like to see as a business model, rather than just tell them a business model? I think the problem is so big that if we can solve it, we can change the world so drastically that it requires for us to be that open and that flexible, I would say. So fingers crossed. It's not an easy task, but I think we will hopefully make it work.
Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
What's the smallest geographic area that could be a test?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So a test can be anywhere. Huh? We can find a school and fly four.